I'm Bay, and you're listening to Bay Baltimore, a weekly pop culture and society podcast recorded in a quiet neighborhood in Baltimore. This episode, I am going to talk about Regina King's newest film, One Night in Miami. So on release day, it's the day after inauguration, also a couple of days after the U.S. observance of Martin Luther King's birthday. And I'm tired of saying that things are strange, but I mean, things are just different, man. And, you know, the feeling that I felt, like, by this time, I would have marched in our Baltimore City's MLK parade. And last year, it was cold, but it wasn't as cold as it has been. I can remember, I'm sure a couple of years ago, I recorded some of the ambiance or the ambient sounds from the MLK parade. I think it was maybe in 2018, and I posted it. And that just, honestly, that only gives you like a taste of what it's like. I think I listened to it maybe 6 or 7 months ago because I was just going through, you know, every once in a while, it's good for you to just go back and listen to your own stuff and listen to where you were and get it, you know, to get a sense of how far you've come and, you know, plot out where you want to go next in terms of the things that you're doing. And so in this instance, I go back to listen to what I thought about a topic back then. And what do I think about it now? Is it worth covering it again? And I missed the opportunity to go out and march, be a part of that parade, which is in celebration to MLK, because for as vanilla as they love to talk about Martin Luther King and for how, you know, innocent a character they make him seem, he was anything but that. Everybody knows that he was flawed as a man. And, you know, fill in the blank on that. Everybody's talked about that at this point. Many people know, I think more people are recognizing that, especially towards the end of his career, the end of his life, because he wasn't at the end of his career, in kind of mid-fame, he was switching gears a little bit, or at the very least becoming more vocal about views that were less respectable, if we're being honest. Like, he was moving away. If we want to go there, he was moving away from respectability politics. He was still very much nonviolent, but he was very much, so when we want to talk about nonviolence, well, let's talk about how violent we are becoming and how things have escalated in the war in Vietnam, in this conflict in Vietnam. Let's talk about how, again, this movement that still exists today, that's being led by Reverend Barber, the Poor People's Movement, where he was making it about, listen, there is a school. Two things can be true at once. Poor people of color got it bad, but also poor white people don't have a great life either. And so what we know is that these people in power who are white and want to push their agenda are very racist and hateful towards Black people and people of color in general. But then they are also using and abusing poor white people too. And there's a synergy here that we can realize. There's something here that we can both mobilize around and seek for justice. And so it was the Poor People's Movement. The Poor People's Campaign was birthed out of that knowledge that poor people in the United States, with all the complexities that still exist, again, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can tackle race issues and inequity issues as it relates to racism, but also just generally also talk about inequities and trying to make sure that everyone has access to the same rights. It's just right. And so this is the point at which he was assassinated. And again, you know, not again, but it's just not something that people talk about. It's not something that people don't talk about, that side of King. They talk about the side that seems harmless. And that has been in the news, definitely in 2020. That was definitely in the news. But nevertheless, so I'm proud to march on MLK Day because it's a great opportunity to not only just, it's something about the spirit. It's something about the spirit and the mood of marchers. I don't know what it's like in any other city. I'm just telling you what it's like in Baltimore. And it is cold as all get out most times. And I think the year that I recorded, it was one of the colder years for the march. And my phone froze because I was recording from my phone. And I was, I think what had happened was I was going to record as much of the ambient noise as I could. You know, just the sounds of the parade, people lining up, people. I think you hear the marching band, one of the many marching bands, but we in our, you know how parades have groups. So they have group one, it has 20 marchers. Group two has so many marchers, group three and so on and so forth. And there's an order to them because you essentially can't put two bands back to back. It'll sound like a cacophony of noise. You also need to be careful who you put behind the horses. You know what I mean? You gotta be careful. Who you putting behind the mobile van or anybody that's in a car. So you got to be careful how you do it. But anyway, we were behind the Enoch Pratt Free Libraries mobile unit, just promoting literacy and making sure that kids and anybody that wanted to check books out at the library could have access to it. And so they're just putting their name out. So we were behind them, but in front of, I can't call if it was the, it wasn't the ACLU. It was a rights group though. I can't call the name of it. It wasn't Planned Parenthood. It was a rights group though, for sure. And then like maybe five or six spaces behind them was a marching band. And again, if you've been in close proximity to a marching band, they're just loud. They're just loud and they got their dancers and everything like that. So anyway, it was just a fun time. And I wish like in that, I tried to do a decent job describing what that feeling is like in that show. And I do recommend you go find it. I think it was from 2018. Anyway, I believe it was called the MLK Day Parade. But yeah, I encourage you to go back and listen. It's not super long, I don't recall. But I'm smiling just talking, thinking about it because I have so many great memories on those cold days. Marching in the MLK parade and layering up, but then also dancing to keep warm on the parade route. It's just a fun time. And so, yeah, so there's that. And then the one time I went to an inauguration, was Barack Obama's first inauguration. Well, actually I went, were we there the day of? Yeah, man. So I went the day before and I took pictures and I can remember I sent my mama a picture of, I must've posted on Facebook or something like that. One of my friends at the time took my picture in front of the Capitol steps where the setup was. And I took that picture and I had my you know, SG Rose stuff on. And somebody in the newspaper at the house, back in the hometown, saw that picture and wanted to post it, you know, to say there's a local connection to the inauguration. And I gave my permission and they interviewed me. And I don't know where that, I think I need to go find it. Because I want to see what I said, you know, or at least what was recorded that I said back in that time. But anyway, I can remember it's just being stupid cold, too many people, and I was overheating. I overheated. And we got into an argument because people were just too much. They were doing too much in my group. And everybody, I remember everybody stayed over my house. Everybody came over my house and stayed. And then we got up early and we drove to, I never forget, we drove to Greenbelt Station. And then we took the train into DC. Because I thought I was gonna be so clever to drive to Greenbelt first and then take the mark, thinking that nobody else is gonna have that thought. And then of course, everybody else had the same thought. And anyway, I remember us being on the train, and I remember there was a point at which, and I cannot remember the stop, but there's several tunnels that when you in DC, there are several tunnels when you're coming out the train station that the escalator is like darn near at a, it's like at a 90 degree angle almost. It's definitely like 75. And anyway, I was in one of those escalators, one of those long escalators. I think it was close to, you remember where the hotel where Reagan, the attempted assassination of Reagan happened? Wherever that hotel was, I was at that train station that wasn't very far from it. And anyway, we were going up somehow or another. Maybe I was there. Girl, I don't remember. Anyway, I just remember being at a steep incline of on an escalator on a steep incline. And I can remember there was a subway police officer that was greeting all of the folks who were coming in, getting off the escalator at the top, saying, open your coat, you finna overheat. You finna overheat, there are too many people in here. It's hot down here, you finna overheat, and I don't want nobody to fall out. And I can remember, oh shoot, that's actually great advice because I'm very hot and I'm sweating. And I can remember thinking that, oh shoot, when I start to sweat, pause, I watch a lot of survival shows, and what they tell you is if you're out in the cold, it's a bad thing for you to sweat because sweat can linger on your skin and cause hypothermia. So you wanna stay as even temperatured as possible. And so if you're working and you start to get warm, open up your coat, take your coat off even, because you don't want all that wetness around you because it's gonna cause trouble for you later. So it instantly when that officer said that, I remember opening up my coat and pushing back my hat so that I could cool off a little bit. And anyway, the push and pull to get there, my goodness. Hoo-wee, I just remember that was a nightmare trying to get as close as we could, knowing that we were like late to the party. And it turned out that we'd only got halfway. We were only halfway to the, in the middle of the mall. And I remember there were pictures of some of my friends that I still have today. And things. And it was just an interesting time. It's very emotional time, largely because there was just, I don't like crowds. I am not a crowd person. I have to prepare for crowds, honestly. And that's just, there's no way for you to prepare for crowds except to say that you gotta psych your mind up to say you're gonna be around a whole bunch of people who gonna touch you and not say sorry. And you gotta be okay with that. Just a glimpse into my mind, but that's how I think, because I have to prepare for certain situations, and I was not properly prepared for the crowd that I saw that day. No, ma'am, I was not properly prepared. And so as a result, I was on edge most of the day because people were too close. They kept touching me and not saying, excuse me, that my feet were being stepped on. I was being violated in the way that I would feel violated left and right. And I just wanted to go home, but I couldn't. And people were asking me questions, and I just wanted them to stop asking me questions. It was a rough day. But knowing what I know now, I can manage crowds differently. But I was not ready for that. I was not ready at all. Nah, if I'm honest, I don't think I'll ever do a crowd that large again. Never. Because you can't control, if somebody breaks out and starts running, you can't control a crowd that size. You just can't. And you cannot predict where are your escape routes. There are people, wall-to-wall people. Where are you going? So I don't think I'll ever, actually, I lied earlier. I'm never going back to a crowd like that again. I will do, you know, when we're able to be in crowds, I used to do Rock the Bells. Y'all remember Rock the Bells? Google Rock the Bells. I used to do those all the time. I think I went to like 4 or 5 of Rock the Bells. I remember the Roots Picnic. I can go to that. Those are crowds, but it's just a little different. Like I can handle those crowds. I guess and I wonder why that is. Is it because for the most part, you know what everybody's on? I don't know. Also, I paid to be in the Roots Picnic. So the Rock the Bells, I always paid to be in the standing space right before the stage. So I was usually always at that barricade between that walking space between the stage and the stage itself. I was usually always up there and I never left because I paid good money. I'm not gonna leave. You just wear better shoes, you know, wear good shoes. So that wasn't an issue. And so while everybody was still kind of tight, everybody kind of, they were kind of cool. You know what I'm saying? They were kind of giving you space a little bit. Yeah, everybody was just kind of cool at Rock the Bells for the most part. But the Roots Picnic, you could move around and stuff. So we moved around and I was always able to find space. Even in those crowds, I was still always able to find space and enjoy myself. With something like the inauguration of the first inauguration of Barack Obama, there's just no way that there was no way that everybody was gonna be cool. You know what I mean? Not everybody was cool. So anyway, I don't know that I'll ever put myself in that position again, but like for a concert, absolutely. And now that they might be social distancing in concerts in the future, like, yeah, I'll do that for sure. Get my own, I will pay for my own little bubble, ma'am. Nobody else in it but me. And the snacks that I bring, yes, ma'am, I'll do that. Anyway, what was I talking about? Oh, the before times. And what would have been, what could have been, but because we can't set ourselves down and do right, here we are, having had no MLK parade, although Eddie Glaude Jr. spoke. And I do love listening to and reading things from Eddie Glaude Jr., Dr. Eddie Glaude Jr. You should look him up. He's controversial because he was one of the first Black voices, or one of the loudest Black voices, that were speaking against the Obama administration. Because let's be clear, like, all you got to do is scratch the surface, baby. Like, I don't prop up Black people just because they're Black. And nobody should prop up somebody from your community just because they're from your community if they don't totally represent you. And the reality of it is, Barack Obama doesn't totally represent me, nor does Michelle. I appreciate them for who they are, and I appreciate them for the platform that they have, but I don't love what they talk about. I don't love what their actions, I don't love their policies, I don't. This whole respectability politics thing that they be talking about, that's not my cup of tea at all, because it's, at this point, it's just doing more damage and it's dividing us even further. Because the reality of it is, you could be a jerk of a person and still not deserve to be murdered on the street. Like, what do you being a jerk and being a drug dealer have to do with the fact that as a person, you don't deserve to be murdered? Like, come on. Anyway, nevertheless, I'm going off the deep end. Ignore me, forgive me. Anyway, yeah, man, I'm over. We're doing what we got to do. And I'm hoping that in this new administration, which is not going to be perfect, is not perfect, already turning out to not be perfect, I'm hoping that Biden makes good on some of his promises. Like, another stimulus check for people who really have been out of work and really need those funds, a boost for these businesses. Like, I can't keep, like, my little orders, me and my husband's little orders, we're doing our part, but we're not keeping these small businesses afloat. We are a small part in a bigger, this is not enough. They need state subsidy. They need state help. And I know that Governor Hogan announced that he was going send some money to these folks, but I'll believe it when I see it. I'll believe it when I see it. You a lame duck governor, and it's possible for you to do just about anything that doesn't ruin your political career, because you can't run for governor again. I think that you might need to break and then you can run again, perhaps. But anyway, it's clear he has political ambitions, so we don't know. We don't know what he's gonna do. But nevertheless, these small businesses need some work. These small businesses need help. These unemployed, these underemployed folks need relief. They need money too. So anyway, I hope and these vaccines, like, my parents still haven't gotten, well, my dad is in the age bracket, but shoot, both of my parents are immune. They are high risk category. They should be getting their vaccines soon. But I know even seniors in the in Maryland who, you know, we've vaccinated a lot of people, but I know a lot of people who've gotten the vaccine, and I still know a lot of people who should be getting it, but haven't gotten it yet, haven't gotten the call. So yeah, I'm hoping that things, I'm praying that things will turn around in a time frame that makes sense, because I was telling my daddy the other day, we just lost one of the last living Tuskegee Airmen, not to old age, but to COVID-19. That's messed up. That's messed up. And if you don't know who the Tuskegee Airmen are, Google them. It's something interesting that you just need to look into. Yeah, so anyway, so I'm just thinking of all of this, and then, you know, MLK weekend, you know, this film, One Night in Miami, drops, and I'm like, okay, well, if I can't do anything but reminisce on, you know, the years past where I've been out on MLK Day at the parade or gone to inauguration, then at the very least, let me sit and watch some other stuff that's entertaining and just get you to think and stimulates the mind. And so I just am happy to share that One Night in Miami did all of that for me. I'm at the point where I want to watch interviews with Regina to see where this brainchild came from, because I actually don't know. I literally just straight out watched it, and I'm actually recording this after I've watched it. I just watched it. Well, no, my bad. I don't know. Anyway, I will have just watched it. Anyway, so yeah, like, this movie was, I gotta be honest with you, I wasn't geeked about it. If I'm honest, I wasn't geeked because I'm harsh about Malcolm X and Malcolm X's character, because I've read so much about him, and I just love to continue reading about him and the circumstances of the time, or what was going on in the time. And so I'm a little bit, I've got a magnifying glass on when people put him in films and people talk about that time frame. I got a magnifying glass on, just because, you know, I grew up, and I've talked about this before, but I grew up, you know, having certain aspects of Black history shoved down my throat, that when I had the opportunity to learn something different, I took it, and I've been doing it ever since. Learning things that I wasn't taught in school, and I've been doing it ever since. And it seems like every day I find something new to learn. Or maybe not every day, but like often I find something new about my Black history that I was never exposed to, or an aspect I was never exposed to, and I just want to learn it. So anyway, so yeah. I gotta be honest with you, the trailer, and I think I kind of share this sentiment in my 30 Coins episode intro, but, or at some point in that show. But yeah, I was a little bit skeptical about how these actors were gonna portray these real life people, but I was fascinated by Leslie Odom Jr. and the fact that he could sing and what he would give in the performance of Sam Cooke. And you've had the benefit of reading the reviews. Leslie Odom does an awesome job, a very awesome job. And this movie raises a whole lot of questions, or at least makes you, if anything, I would hope that would make you look into these real life people. But then it gives you a different perspective on something that may have actually happened. Like, what it gives you, it allows your mind to travel to a scenario in which Malcolm X, Muhammad Ali, Sam Cooke, and Jim Brown were in the same room, and were buddies and were in the same room for hours talking about various subjects, but ultimately all connected back to being a Black entertainer, being a Black celebrity in this time frame, and what that meant, the immense pressure that each one of these folks were under, and what the different stressors meant for them in a pivotal point in their life. And so in the next segments, I will talk about the characters themselves, or at least the people that are portrayed in this thing, and then I'll give the I'll come back and I'll give the context about it too. So stay tuned. Okay, so let me get to the particulars. One night in Miami. The synopsis of the thing is, on the night of February 25th, 1964 in Miami, Cassius Clay joins Jim Brown, Sam Cooke, and Malcolm X, and they discuss the responsibility of being successful Black men during the Civil Rights Movement. I think that's a fair synopsis. I think there's a lot missing out of that synopsis, but yeah, if you boil it all down, yeah, they're talking about success, but there's a reason why they've been brought together. And I'll go into that. But like I said, directed by Regina King, screenplay by Kent Powers. Don't know who that is. Cinematography by Tammy Riker. Don't know who that is. It's a bunch of producers. And it stars Leslie Odom Jr. as Sam Cooke, Kingsley Ben-Adir as Malcolm X, Eli Gorey as Cassius Clay, and Aldis Hodge as Jim Brown. There are other people who were in this film. Everybody will remember or recognize Lance Riddick, who played in The Wire and a bunch of other things. There are other people in here, but the main characters are Sam Cooke, Malcolm X, Cassius Clay, and Jim Brown. And it literally takes place on one night. And the night that it takes place just happens to be the night of Cassius Clay's victory. He won, what do I want to do here? I'm so excited about talking about this film that I think instead of just surmising, talking about every single scene, I think what I want to do is talk about the historical context to all of this. Because the reality of it is, while this is all of these people, all of these names that I just mentioned, Jim Brown, Cassius Clay, Malcolm X, Sam Cooke, were friends. It's true that they were friends. It's true that they were all in Miami on the night of Cassius Clay at the time, his fight. What is not true, and certainly what is fantasy in this film, is that they got together and talked about what it meant to be a successful Black man in during the Civil Rights Movement, right? What the context that's missing out of here is so rich and so full that it's like, I'm excited about this because of the context that's not included in this film. I enjoy the fantasy that is putting them all in a room together. But to know that the significance of the Cassius Clay Sonny Liston fight, the significance of why Malcolm X was in Miami at that moment, the significance what I know ended up happening to Sam Cooke. All of that kind of swirls around in my mind, and it's like I don't even know where to go first. But I guess what I will say is that in introducing each of these characters, in introducing the film adaptation of these real life people, we are given a glimpse into their lives apart from each other. So in the opening scene, we're introduced to Cassius Clay, who everybody knows is Muhammad Ali, right? But we are introduced to Cassius Clay, who's in the ring. He looks to be over in Europe, and he's fighting some guy, and he's showboating and doing all of this stuff. And his training people have had it. Me and my daddy would watch boxing when I grew up. It was one of the things that we did together, and so I recognized his trainers to be like folks that people talked about, because they helped, they helped the great Muhammad Ali hone his boxing skills, right? So long story short, there's a scene where Muhammad Ali is in the ring in Europe. He's fighting this white guy, and he's boxing, 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 and then he's running his mouth, And then he takes his eye off the ring and gives his opponent an opportunity to bop him in his chin. And of course he falls out. But nevertheless, he you know, and that's a big deal because up until this point, he had had this man on the ropes and was giving him the what for. And it looked like he was going to run away with the show. But in actuality, like when Cassius opened himself up for that hit, it energized the crowd against him. And everybody knows how much of a heel that Cassius Clay had turned himself into. Like he enjoyed being the bad guy because it just, you know, he just got a kick out of that. So anyway, so he's knocked down and everybody's like excited that he's knocked down, but he ends up winning the fight on a technicality. Not even a technicality, it's just he got knocked down and then the bell rung, which gave him an opportunity to catch his breath. And then he ended up winning the fight. And so he's young, he's 22 years old at this point. And so we see him in this fight and it's like, okay. You know, he is a talented so-and-so that is got mouth for days. And is that it seems very much that he is impressionable. And he's at a point in his life where he's about to make some life-changing decisions. What we know is this is on the cusp of him declaring that he is a Muslim and a member of Nation of Islam, right? So we see him and he has the fight with Sonny Liston. I'm gonna come back to Sonny Liston in a minute, but let me just go back. So the next scene is Jim Brown. And Jim Brown is, forgive me, I literally just watched it, but Jim Brown is going home to an island off the coast of Georgia. And he's, you know, his mama or some relative, older relative told him to go see this white man who has been a part of their family or at least close to their family for generations. And so he goes and he's driving a fancy car and he's the big Jim Brown who's been playing with the Browns, I think, and, you know, breaking records and all of this stuff and is super famous. And so he goes to this white man's house and, you know, they sit on the porch and he's greeted by the white man's grandchild. This is an older white gentleman, white guy. And he's greeted by their the guy's grandchild and welcomed with open arms and all of that stuff and all the pleasantries that you would expect someone who loves someone else or just appreciates the heck out of somebody else coming to see them after having not seen them for a long time. Anyway, so they're sitting on the porch, Jim Brown and the old man, and they're talking this, that, and the third. And then there comes a point where the old man's granddaughter comes out and interrupts their conversation to remind the granddad that he needs to move a piece of furniture. And so the granddad says, okay, well, hold on a minute, Jim, I'm gonna get up, I'm gonna do this. Jim uses this opportunity that while the old man is walking through the threshold and into the house, into the foyer, into the house, he says, oh, from the porch, he's calling. He's like, oh, well, let me help you with that. Let me help you with that. And the old man turns to him and matter of factly says, oh, no, thank you. You know, I got this. And besides, we don't let niggas in the house. Or something to that effect. You know, we don't let niggas in the house. And then he keeps moving like it was like he just said, it's, you know, it's raining outside. And then Jim Brown, of course, got the doo-doo face, just looks stupid because he's like, I thought we was real tight and you were giving me all this love, only for him to turn around and remind him that in this the image of this white man, you're only good for being my pet, my toy at this point. And so the next scene we see, I can't remember if it's Sam or if it's Malcolm. The next scene, I'll just describe the next scene that I remember. The next scene that I remember is Sam Cooke preparing to go on stage. He's backstage at the Copacabana. Copacabana is a famous club. Everybody, Barry Manilow has a song about Copacabana. It was a famous club back in the 60s, 50s, 60s, I think it might have closed down in the 70s, but anyway, or probably in the 40s it opened. But anyway, very famous club in Miami. Everybody played there. Famously racist in terms of Black people could perform there, but they couldn't sit in the audience, and they had, you know, to enter from separate rooms or separate entrances and things like that. So anyway, so you have, so he goes on stage and he's getting grief because of the way he wants his show set up. So Copacabana has a very strict guidelines in terms of how the show is going to be set up. And so, you know, he's getting grief from the stage manager on how to perform his show right before he's about to go on. So he finally relents to whatever the demands of the stage manager is so that he can go on stage. So he goes on and he begins to perform, and the song that he's singing is like a ballad. And the crowd that is white, or at least white presenting, are not having whatever it is that he's singing. And in truth, I'm not even familiar with the song that he was singing. And oh, sidebar, Leslie Odom is singing. And of course, Leslie Odom can sing. So anyway, so he's singing. And of course, the crowd is not here for whatever he's singing. So people get up and begin to leave. And of course, you know, Sam is a consummate professional, but you fast forward and it, you know, you see him in his dressing room with his people and he's livid. You get the sense that this whole thing went terrible and he just had a bad night. He bombed and he has a blow up with his manager and all of that stuff. But nevertheless, the reality was the crowd wasn't there for him. They weren't here for the song. They weren't feeling the song that he was singing. And it just, you know, he had a bad night. And so, and I guess what's different from the Jim Brown scene and the Cassius Clay scene is I actually believe, unless I'm mistaken, I believe that Sam Cooke was actually in Miami on the night of the fight. I can't remember. Hold on, let me go back. The 25th. Like, I feel as if he was in Miami that night, and he was like, well, let me just call it a doggone day. Let me go see my friend who's about to box. I don't know. I can't be sure. But anyway, it feels like he was already in Miami. And then there's the scene with Malcolm. And I cannot remember much of the scene. And I don't know why that is, and I apologize. But anyway, so long story short, we're introduced to all of these folks. What we know instantly, the last thing that I missed, but that I want to mention is that Sam was in Miami with his wife. And it's clear that there was some strain there. Oh my gosh, I have a story about all of them, except for Jim Brown. I really don't have much of a story for Jim Brown. Because if I'm honest, I have had an interest in all of the people mentioned except for Jim Brown, only because I just never resonated with him as a person. And the only Jim that I know of now is the one that I just don't connect with Jim Brown. The last thing I heard about Jim Brown is that you ought to stand for the flag and the athletes are being disrespectful to the flag. And I just didn't resonate. Like, he definitely struck me like he was not on Colin Kaepernick's side. And so and maybe that's a shame on my part, because I have never connected with Jim Brown. I knew how much of an outsider he was. I knew how opinionated he was, especially being a Black man, even an athlete, but nevertheless a Black man, and how he was, I don't know what he did with his platform, except that he did at times align himself with civil rights leaders. But I don't really know much about Jim Brown. So I have a vested interest, though, in big ways and small ways with all the other characters. In a small way with Sam Cooke, only because he led an interesting life. Cassius Clay, because I was a fan of boxing and always have been. And then Malcolm X, because he was, and I've shared this several times before at this point, but he was the first leader outside of the first civil rights era leader outside of Martin Luther King that I learned about. He was like my gateway into learning about the Black Panthers and Angela Davis and Fannie Lou Hamer, and reading more about just different Black leaders from different generations. But like Malcolm X was my entryway into that, only because just because it, you know, it was an opportunity for me to learn something that they weren't trying to push down my throat in school. So anyway, I think I have seen just about every documentary. I have read multiple books and listened to multiple podcasts about Malcolm X. So he, of all of these characters, he is the one that I have the most, I'm the most knowledgeable about what happened in his life leading to his assassination. But that's not saying much, because it's not like I know everything. Anyway, so they all converge on this night. And this night, the night that Cassius knocks out Sonny, is the night where they're supposed to be meeting. And now let me just say that it appears as if they were all at the fight. So let me give you the scenario. So Cassius Clay is up there boxing Sonny Liston. In the on the ringside, giving a blow by blow of the fight, is Jim Brown and some other sports commentators. In the crowd is Sam Cooke with his wife enjoying the boxing match. And in the middle to the back is Malcolm X enjoying the bout and taking pictures too. And it's clear, the one thing this movie really showed, and I'm glad that they did, is that Malcolm X was a photo, he had the photo bug. He would take photos all the time. He was always documenting things with his camera. And so anyway, so they're all there and Cassius Clay knocks out Sonny Liston. Everybody rejoices. And I don't exactly know how this happened, but somehow or another, everybody makes their way to Malcolm's hotel room. And the important thing that you need to know about this whole scenario is that Sam Cooke, because he was playing for the Copacabana, he was put up in a fancy hotel that was a white hotel, basically. And Malcolm X and everybody else who was in town, Jim Brown and Cassius Clay, were staying in the white side of town, or the Black side of town. And Malcolm X was put up in a Black hotel. And so anyway, so one by one, they make their way to Malcolm's hotel. And Sam Cooke is the one that gets there first. And he entertains himself because he brings his guitar in. And I guess one of the things that we're supposed to remember or supposed to know is that Sam Cooke rarely went anywhere without his guitar. Or at the very least, he didn't feel like traveling this time without his guitar. And I even make a mention of it when they're all in the room. Sam, you brought your guitar. He's like, I don't trust this. I'm not going to leave this. This guitar is going to come with me. It's always going to come with me. So anyway, and so the scene of this whole movie essentially takes place in Malcolm X's hotel room on the roof of his hotel. And there's a point at which Cassius and Sam lead to go to a liquor store around the corner from the hotel. So there are only a few places where this entire movie takes place, but the bulk of it is right there in Malcolm X's hotel room. And we explore the bathroom, we explore the mini bar, we explore the dining room, we explore, the front room where the beds are. He's in a double bed suite. And we also get acquainted with his bodyguards, who are always on their post outside of his door. Because at the time, Malcolm X was with the Nation of Islam. Cassius Clay was again on the cusp of being declaring his that he was a Muslim and that his name was Malcolm X. What we know is that I said Malcolm X. He was declaring his name to be Muhammad Ali. Malcolm X was on the cusp of being of splitting with the Nation of Islam because of information that he found out about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And Jim Brown was on the cusp of making a life-changing career decision. He was thinking about walking away from football altogether. And Sam Cooke was finding his voice in the movement. Successful businessman at that point, making money hand over fist, but finding his way in the entertainment business. And so that is essentially, in the nutshell, is what everybody's dealing with. And when you get into the room, of course, there are very tense situations throughout this whole thing. It's very clear that, again, this is a fictionalized story, but from what I've read and learned about Malcolm, I don't believe it's too far or too hard to imagine that to be a friend of Malcolm would be kind of difficult sometimes, because you would always be reminded of your responsibility, especially if you had an opportunity to sway and influence communities of folks, you would be reminded of that obligation. And so throughout this movie, what we see is that Malcolm is goading in many ways, all of them, but is specifically Sam Cooke, because of between Jim Brown and Cassius Clay, Sam Cooke is the one that's still kind of making vanilla songs and talking about love all the time in a time that Malcolm X points out himself is extremely tumultuous and extremely dangerous for Black people, and too dangerous for you to sit on the sidelines. And so there's a push and pull there. And so the synopsis it talks about the heart of the conversation, which is, what is your responsibility as a Black person who has power and influence? What are you going to do with your power and influence? And certainly the person that's asking that question in a million and two different ways is Malcolm X. But there's something else that's happening there as well. They're literally all on the cusp of something brand new, and they're all under stress in one way or the next, but no one is more under stress than Malcolm X, because the difference between the scare and the anxiety that everyone else is living with, and again, it's a big deal for you to come out and to leave one religion and go to another, and in leaving that religion, you could potentially alienate your whole family. You also would change your lifestyle to be in accordance with that religion and that spiritual life. So that is one very big life change from going from, in the case of Jim Brown, your whole career and your notoriety was built on your physical prowess on the football and your ability on the football field. And to walk away from that, to walk into a territory which, for the most part, is completely unknown. And there's no guarantee that you're going to be the same type of hotshot that you were in football, is a scary thing, right? Then you have Sam Cooke, which again, his struggle is, so I'm making money, I'm making these business moves. And what we know is, if you just scratch the surface of Sam Cooke, you recognize that he's a pretty shrewd businessman, but was, in being a shrewd businessman, you know what sells and what doesn't, but you're at the point at which we find Sam Cooke at the point where he's deciding, okay, if I do this, I might not make any money, but I might be helping my people who look like me. And deciding if him being a business owner and putting other Black artists on is good enough, you know? So, and you get the sense that he's always thought that, no, it's actually not good enough. And so that's explored. And then finally, back to Malcolm X, the one that they're all there for. Malcolm X is under, at this point, extreme stress. Extreme in the extreme. That you get a glimpse of the stress that he's under when you in some of the scenes where he's looking out of the window being paranoid because he sees the same two white faces that he thinks he's seen following him in another point in time, when he calls his wife and they're talking about what, I remember the scene. But anyway, let me hasten on. So anyway, when he calls his wife and they're talking, and you can hear that she's trying to suss out whether or not he's under stress. He's even more stressed and even more paranoid, and he's trying to suss out what's going on in the home life, and like, are they being harassed? Would she even tell him? And so what we know is that not too long after this fictitious meeting, which may or may not have happened, we know that Malcolm X wasn't long for this world, and he actually was assassinated not too long after. Right? Makes the whole thing of even this that much more heavy when you think of that context. Now I have more context that I'll provide, and I'm just trying to figure out the best way to do it. And I think what I'll do is I'll just go one by one, because yeah, I think I'll go one by one, and I'll start with Cassius Clay and Sonny Liston. I'll leave Malcolm X for the last because the movie left Malcolm X for the last. But I'm gonna for the very last because that was the heaviest. That was the heaviest. But I'll talk about Sonny Liston and Cassius Clay, then I'll move to Sam Cooke. And I'll talk about Jim Brown, and then I will end with Malcolm X in this next segment. Okay? Okay, so let me just take a break right quick.
Okay, so before I go on the train of thought that I said I was going to go on, I do want to share the scene that we are introduced in this film to Malcolm X and his wife, Betty. And so this is how it went. We were introduced to Cassius first, then we were introduced to Jim Brown, then we were introduced, if I'm thinking about it correctly, then we were introduced to Sam, and then we were introduced to Malcolm. And in the introduction to Malcolm, he is in a hotel room, or maybe he's at the house, maybe he's at his home. So he's at his home in Harlem, I believe. And he's talking to Betty, and this is one of the moments. This is the aftermath of him going public, or at least learning about how allegedly the leader of the... oh my gosh, why am I drawing a blank? It's not the Muslim Brotherhood. That is a totally different organization. Nation of Islam. The leader of the Nation of Islam, the Honorable Minister Elijah Muhammad, had fathered several children and had several mistresses, and were putting those mistresses and their kids up in squalor, basically. They're these mistresses and children were living in squalor. And this was right after he had, if you know just even a bit, if you've watched Malcolm X, then you know that Malcolm, people began coming to Malcolm at the height of his fame with the Nation of Islam. People began Islam began coming to him, sharing these stories, these tales of abuse from the leader. Or about the leader. And it was at this point that Malcolm was deciding, okay, well, what can be done here? And I don't think at this point he had decided to split from the Nation of Islam. I think in these moments, and certainly what the moment, maybe not the moment that, actually not at the moment where the movie picks up with him, but there was a certain point where it seemed as if he was just going to expose the information, expose the leader, and try to stay with the Nation. But it became clear at a point that staying was not an option for Malcolm, so leaving was the best option. And so, where we pick up in the film is Malcolm has amassed all of this information. All of these people have come forward to him, and he's ready to share the information. And I believe he had, he has actually already shared all of the information that he's received to leadership, and that he hasn't been believed. And it's at this point where he's on, he's been put on suspension from speaking. Up until this point, up until we meet Malcolm in 1963, because remember, this is February 25th, 1964. So I believe the months before this, and only a few months, because if this is February 1964, President Kennedy was assassinated December 19th, 1963, I believe, which means that Malcolm made some that controversial statement that I think everybody who knows a little bit about Malcolm knows, that Malcolm X made a controversial statement following the death of John Kennedy, where he essentially said, in reference to how do you feel about his death, a reporter asking this, he said, sounds like it's essentially chickens coming home to roost. Now, what we know with the benefit of time is that this was a combination of Malcolm X being big and bold and a loudmouth, but being provocative. But then also portions of the truth, because it's not to say that Kennedy deserved what he got, is how it was explained. And certainly how Malcolm X, how people that are familiar with Malcolm X explain that statement, careless as it was, poorly worded as it was, it wasn't that Malcolm was saying that, good, I'm glad that President Kennedy was shot. More so, look at the fallacy that is this culture that you've created. You have someone that is you're supposed to be your golden boy. Now you've propped him up, and now the golden boy doesn't tap dance for you. And now even you turn on him. The treachery of this world that you created is you will even turn on those that you've propped up if they don't sing your song, dance your dance. In other words, yeah. So, and what do we know about the Kennedy assassination? We don't know anything definitively, but there have been rumors for years that are at this point are believed to be true, that he was taken out by the mob because of the his brother largely cracking down, Robert Kennedy cracking down on mobs and their activities. And the Kennedy and his father made a lot of deals. I mean, that's the allegation, that he made deals to put Kennedy where he was, to be able to win, to get the political advantage that he got. You know, his dad was known for being, you know, backdoor Johnny, being, you know, getting things done by hook or by crook. And mostly what history recounts, and certainly a lot of scholars believe, is that he got a lot of things done by crook. And so, you know, I think it's fact at this point that Kennedy had mob ties. One of their ties being I can't call the name of the family, but it wasn't the Gambino family. It's the only family that I'm remembering. And I think I had no connection with him, but definitely he had ties with Italian mob members, or American Italian mob members. Anyway, and so that is what folks are saying that Malcolm X was referring to when he said, sounds like chickens coming home to roost. Nevertheless, that got him into a whole lot of trouble across the globe. It wasn't received well, and then it was definitely not received well within the nation, certainly not by Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And this is in the midst of him finding out he's still beholden to Muhammad. But this is also in the midst of him learning this information about his alleged the misconduct. And so, yeah, so he sat down in December. The president is assassinated in December 1963. And he sat, and Malcolm is set down, meaning he can't, he's forbidden to do forbidden to be the, I forgot what his title was, but basically perform the duties that he was accustomed to doing, which is essentially being the mouthpiece of the Nation of Islam. Because he was the most charismatic, and it made sense in his role to be the spokesperson. So he sat down, and then I think in this moment, it's again where he's learning this information. So anyway, one of the ways that, and I learned this recently, I learned this actually in the documentary that I watched in last year, like early spring of last year, about finding Malcolm's killer or killers or assassins, was that the reason why Malcolm went to Miami, and we talk about this in the movie, the concept is broached, like we go there, that the reason why Malcolm went to Miami was to recruit Muhammad Ali, to continue recruiting. It's not like this is the first time they had met. When the movie picks up, it's clear that they've been friends for a minute. And so this is true, but I think this is the turn in their relationship. This is the turn where, you know, he's trying to, and it's real, and it's exposed in the film, that Malcolm is turning or is leading Muhammad Ali to Islam. And it's a mutually beneficial thing for all involved. So for the Nation of Islam, you got this big time black athlete who is outspoken and a role model to many generations of people, or especially young people at that time. And they can help be a recruitment tool for the Nation of Islam. Can help be a role model and a recruitment tool for the Nation of Islam. In Cassius Clay's perspective, it's centering him, it's giving him more meaning, and he's not just a loudmouth anymore. He's a person with a big voice and a big platform, and he's using his platform for things that matter, right? And so I think shortly after this, you know, after he joins the Nation of Islam, he burns his draft card or something like that, and so his actions are intentional. And so the benefit for, I'm sure, I 100% without question, what we know is that Muhammad Ali died a Muslim, which means I believed in his heart that he was a practicing Muslim. I don't think this was for show. He was a practicing Muslim. But the benefit to 22-year-old Cassius Clay at the time was that this kind of refines him. It refines his image, if we're being honest. And then for Malcolm, he takes on this assignment to recruit his friend, or a person that he's become close with, to call a friend, because this is also one of his ways to get back into the good graces of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm and the Nation of Islam, even though he's still exposing, he has this information. So I think the movie moves too quickly to the split, to the point at which they're about to split, Malcolm and the Nation. But nevertheless, I think it's important to share in there, in that moment. So not only is he using Muhammad Ali as a last-ditch effort to reconnect with, get back in the good graces of the leadership in Nation of Islam, but he's also just, you know, he's a broken person. He's becoming broken at this point. And he's conflicted because this person that he's idolized and looked up to and really admires is not infallible anymore. And we all have that where you know, they say don't meet your idols, because, you know, they're going to look very flawed to you. You're going to find out that they have the flaws you never knew existed before, and that might crush you. And so anyway, so he's at this point. Now, the what we know is that Malcolm X totally splits from the Nation of Islam. But in the split, what the movie rushes to is that Malcolm intended for Muhammad Ali to follow him And what the movie doesn't follow him in this new organization. So follow him away from the Nation of Islam and follow him to this new organization. And I think it was one night. So they kind of had to put it all in that one night. It certainly didn't happen that way. I don't know that that Malcolm made the pitch on the night of February 29th, or 25th, but I'm sure he made the pitch somewhere shortly thereafter. And so what do we know? We see in the movie that we see in the movie that Malcolm's being harassed. He's out of the shadow and out of the protection. He's left the protection, the umbrella of protection of the Nation of Islam. He's branched out on his own, created his whole new group, and his house is being firebombed. Meanwhile, we see at the end, we see Cassius professing himself to be Muhammad Ali, and he's standing up there coming out in, I think it's temple number one, the one in Detroit where Elijah Muhammad oversaw, and he's standing at the pulpit basically, and all the leaders are there, and there's one missing chair where Malcolm X used to sit, and it's on the end. And in that moment, what that's supposed to represent is that Cassius Clay made his choice, or Muhammad Ali made his choice to go with the Nation, to side with the Nation and not Malcolm. And I think that's a big moment. That is a huge moment, because the context there is Malcolm had first started to go down there to recruit Muhammad Ali for the Nation of Islam, but then wanted him to join his organization, and he didn't. And we don't know what that meant for his friendship, but what that meant for Malcolm itself is he made him an even bigger target. He was even more alone, more isolated. And what we know is he ultimately ended up being assassinated. Now, the Nation of Islam and members of the Nation of Islam vehemently deny any involvement with Malcolm's death, his assassination. And there's been speculation for years that that's just not true. And we still don't know. And that's why there are documentaries being released as late as 2020 about the assassination of Malcolm X, because how is it that one of the most prolific leaders, one of the most outspoken people, biggest personalities, is assassinated and we don't know who did it? And then what we know is that there were people who were charged in connection with the assassination, but they had help. And so we don't know who those helpers were. So anyway, it's just fascinating. And so that's the context that's missing. But the other thing that I did want to say, and I'm going to get to it, is I wanted to, again, I can't really speak much about Jim Brown, because I don't connect with him. But Sam Cooke Muhammad Ali and Sonny Liston, those characters. And I won't even go into Muhammad Ali anymore, because I think I've already done that. I've covered that. But I will go into the fighter that he fought and what the significance of that fight on the February 25th. And the significance of that fight, and again, I love basketball. Oh my gosh, I'm all over the place. I love boxing for the opportunity that it creates so many poor Black and brown people. Heck of a sport, very dangerous, but the opportunity and escape that it still affords Black and brown, poor Black and brown people is just unmatched. Second to the Army, honestly, but even the Army, anyway, I won't go there. So the fight between Sonny Liston and, at the time, Cassius Clay was essentially the Black Power boxer versus the Uncle Tom boxer. And the Uncle Tom in this scenario was Sonny Liston. And what you don't know is Sonny Liston was a Golden Globe boxer. He was a good boxer, had been a very good boxer. Led up to this fight, he quit. He quit the match, absolutely did quit the match between Muhammad Ali, because there was so much stress and pressure on him, calling him an Uncle Tom, saying he's a traitor to the race. Like, he got so much grief after this bout, probably before, but definitely after, Sonny Liston's life completely went to in shambles. He became dependent on drugs, and kind of just lost that luster for boxing and kind of just went downhill from there. I will leave you to look up Sonny Liston and understand the nature of his death and understand the last days of his life and the last couple of years of his life, but it wasn't great, is my point. And to the amount of intense pressure that was resting on entertainers, athletes, and anyone in the public eye, any Black person in the public eye during that time was so immense, especially specifically in the diaspora in the United States, was so immense, it was unbelievable, to the point at which you literally have two black folks and you pit one against the other. And it's literally that everybody that's for Sonny Liston, you're Uncle Tom's and you're for white people, and you're fine with the status quo. Everybody that's with Cassius Clay, you are for black people, and you are not fine with the status quo, and you're gonna speak out. And of course, the white media, the white controlled news media at the time, definitely were very, very much, and it was conservative too. Definitely much on the side of Sonny Liston. And so they fanned the flames of this thing. And it's just so unfortunate because there's space for different. It just sucks that it had to be binary. This, you're either with black people or you're not. You are either militant or you're not. And the same could be said about Sam Cooke and pushing him and the way that Malcolm X pushed him. It's just, it was not fair. And Sonny Liston is not the biggest example of the aftermath of being labeled an Uncle Tom, because certainly, what do we know? We know that to a certain extent, James Brown was labeled an Uncle Tom until he switched his routine up, right? But so we know that he was under pressure. Every black leader in whatever arena was under pressure to be a certain way, to make sure that they were, and I hope I'm not generalizing this too much, but they were just under immense pressure. And so the sad story of Sonny Liston is one that everybody should know, because it shouldn't have happened. But he was essentially a casualty of the civil rights movement too. But not to say that the civil rights movement itself was polarizing, because it shouldn't have been polarizing. Everyone should have been on the side of making sure that black people and brown people had the same rights that white people were afforded. But nevertheless, that's just not how it shook out. That's not how it worked. And so unless you were out there protesting and doing things that you could see in the public eye, you were not seen as for the movement. And I just, again, everybody needs to understand the story of Sonny Liston, because it's a sad one. Just as much as you need to understand the real story of Muhammad Ali, because it's a complex one. And I love the push and pull. I love the push and pull that was displayed in this movie. I just, you know, it's one night and it can't do everything. So I love that this movie will undoubtedly encourage a lot of people to learn more about everyone that you talk about. And the Sam Cooke piece, I think that what I want to say about Sam Cooke is that, you know, it's so unfortunate. He was such a, you know, titan in the music industry and a shrewd businessman, but also he led a very conflicted life. And what we know is a few short months after this night that allegedly happened, February 25th, what we know, February 25th, 1964, is that by December, Sam Cooke was dead. No, excuse me, by the, wait, hold on, let me look. So what we know is that Sam Cooke, hold on, let me do this right. Sam Cooke passed away. This night happened on, So this night happened on February 25th. Sam Cooke was dead by December 11th. So his life took a turn quickly. And, you know, I'll leave it to you to look up the circumstances of his death, but he was murdered. He was murdered. And there are allegations that led to it, but it's clear that he was in some sort of, I think the prevailing thought is that he was either one, assaulting a woman, he just got reckless and assaulted a woman, or was being robbed and chose to assault a woman. Either way, the end is not great for Sam Cooke in this instance. And his legacy is tarnished because of that end. A little bit tarnished, because I don't even think people really know how Sam Cooke died. But it was wild. And it shouldn't have happened. But I think people know more about the scandal with Bobby Womack and Sam Cooke's daughter and things like that. Anyway, a couple of months later, Sam Cooke was dead out of his crew. Sam Cooke was dead. And a few months after that, Malcolm X passed away. Malcolm X was assassinated. So, that's what happened. Of the three, I wonder, or of the four, so two of them passed away within short order, within less than a year from that meeting. And I wonder if Muhammad Ali and Jim Brown grew apart. I'm guessing that they did, based on their life paths. And certainly Jim Brown was older than Muhammad Ali, but I do wonder if they kept in touch. I think the context, knowing the context of this story, this film, makes it that much richer to see the conflict here and there. And again, I love the fact that it doesn't take place in too many, like the heart of the movie really takes place in the hotel room, and some of it atop the hotel roof of this motel that's doing the best that it can for itself. But essentially a black motel, or motel for black folks. In this room where essentially Malcolm X is unraveling, and it's clear he's unraveling because he's under immense pressure. And then if you're honest, all of them are dealing with their struggles, not their little struggles. These are monumentous big time struggles. And it's fascinating. I enjoyed this immensely. I really did enjoy it. There were some tough questions being asked. I wish there was more time. I found myself scrutinizing the actor that played Malcolm X, and that's not fair because I think so highly of Malcolm X, and I just think so highly of Denzel's performance, portrayal of Malcolm X, that it's hard to compete. But what we know that Mario Van Peebles played Malcolm X. We know he did a decent job, you know, in terms of looks. There's a look to Malcolm X you got to get. There's a look to actually all of these artists, all of these actors, all of these people that were portrayed. There's a look that you got to get if you're going to get that thing right. I think Aldis he did okay for Jim Brown. Again, I don't have much to say about Jim Brown, but Aldis is beautiful. Leslie did a good Sam Cooke. You look at the picture of Sam Cooke and then you look at Leslie Odom Jr. He did a good Sam Cooke. And then his affect, his speech, did a good Sam Cooke. Even put on he even code switched like Sam Cooke, or the interviews that you've seen of Sam Cooke. Muhammad Ali, I struggled with the actor's accent, or how I struggled with the actor's Muhammad Ali accent, but I think maybe I'm forgetting how Muhammad Ali talked, you know? But then Malcolm X, I think the actor, like I was nitpicking it, but ultimately the actor did a very fine job. Very fine job with Malcolm X. And I just recommend this. I recommend it. It's an interesting movie. It's not gonna give you everything. It's not gonna give you everything that you need. I don't quite think it's not 100%, but it's like 90 for me. It's like 90%. I really enjoyed this film. It's a good story, even if it's not entirely true. But the idea that all of these four people who represent different aspects of Black leadership, Black male leadership, because again, you got to say Black male leadership, because I want a night in Miami with the Black women leaders. I want that. And I know something like that happened, but I want that. I want Shirley Chisholm in the room with Coretta Scott King and Betty Shabazz, if that's possible. And maybe that didn't happen, but anyway.
Yeah, so watch this film. It's great. Regina King did her thing. She did a very great job. And Leslie Odom can sing. I love his voice. Anyway, watch this film. Give it some play. And look up these characters. Look up these real life people. Look up Sonny Liston. You really need to look into Sonny Liston. Look more into Malcolm X and get an understanding of Sam Cooke's passing, because it's not great. But it gives more context to the struggle that he even clearly was dealing with in 1964, leading right up to his death. Definitely watch this. And I'm very excited about all of the shows that are coming out. I just can't wait. The fact that Netflix is coming out with something new every week, I'm excited about that, because I feel confident that there's going to be something that I'll love to watch in it. All these other upcoming movies, I'm just excited to watch. I'm ready for it. I'm ready for new. So I got a lot of stuff that I want to talk about, and I just want to keep it all together. So thank you so much for listening. I hope you stick around and continue listening and liking and giving 5 stars and leaving great notes, because I'll definitely read them on the show. Sharing the episodes with people you care about or people that you think that might find these things interesting. I just appreciate you for doing that. So thanks again so much for listening. Have a wonderful day. Until next time.